Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and get an update on the G20 summit in Cannes from a specialist on European economies, Amy Verdun, the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. We will discuss the day's activities that were overshadowed by the Greek crisis provoked by a call for a referendum that the Greek Prime Minister has since retracted. Then we will examine the latest rumors of war about the long-standing possibility that Israel will attack Iran, as well as recent signals that the United States might attack Iran next year. Investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus joins us to examine these rumors, which he disputes in an article currently in The Nation. But we will explore these scenarios as tensions have been recently heightened over an assassination plot and a forthcoming report from the IAEA about Iran's nuclear program. Then, to get another perspective on these rumors of war, we will speak with Richard Sale, who has reported on intelligence since the 1970s and has an article at Truthout, U.S. and Israeli tech teams develop malware to take down Iran's computer software. We will discuss the extent to which sabotage has slowed the Iranian nuclear program and why a military attack would be necessary, not to mention disastrous and counterproductive. Joining us now is Amy Verdun, who's a professor and chair of political science at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Her books include European Response to Globalization and Financial Market Integration, Globalization, Development and Integration, and her latest, Ruling Europe, the Politics of the Stability and Growth Pact. She is also co-editor of the Journal of Common Market Studies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amy Verdun.
Hi, Ian.
And you are in Europe as the G20 summit takes place in Cannes. And at this point, of course, prior to this, a deal was made. Merkel and Sarkozy managed to make the bankers take a 50% haircut on their Greek debt. And then suddenly, a few days later, this deal is blown up by a grenade tossed into the works by the Greek Prime Minister, who called for a referendum. He's facing a no-confidence vote. He has reversed himself on the referendum and is trying to work out some kind of a deal with the opposition, however unlikely that is. But in the meantime, of course, just those simple actions of his, perhaps, you know, out of his political selfishness, caused the price of Italian debt to go up and the price of Portuguese, Irish and Spanish debt as well. And, of course, brought down a brokerage house here in the United States run by former governor of New Jersey, Corzine. So quite a lot of wreckage has been done so far. So any good news from today's activities?
It's interesting you should put it all in that long list. Indeed, I think it was one of the most turbulent days we've seen in international politics in a long time. I think people were a bit upset because the Greek Prime Minister decided this without consulting with anybody. There was some leakage today that suggested he may have spoken to somebody and that they may have heard about it, but that was quickly withdrawn. So the big issue here was that he put this referendum to the people without consulting his partners. The reasons why the partners were upset about this is because they would have never been making that a deal on the 26th of October to help the Greeks out with the haircut and the package and expanding the European Financial Stability Fund if they had known that he would put it to a referendum. The whole point of last week was to make sure that there was some stability and calmness in the market. There was a lot of jittering in that week about what could Europe do, and they were extremely pleased with themselves when they managed to get the package arranged, and it still needed to be sold to a lot of people, whether it was the right amount, whether it was the right type of package, were the details right. So just having the Greek Prime Minister wreaking havoc with all that by putting a referendum to the people was what made people very upset.
But I suppose politicians, it may be too much to ask for them to have more altruistic and global views than their own parochial interests. And even our own leader, President Obama, is there at the G20, motivated largely, because he doesn't want the European economy to drag down the American economy, which is already a millstone around his neck.
Yes. It's interesting. I think the whole situation here must really be seen from a sort of a two-level game situation. In political science, we often speak about what people do, politicians, that is, at the domestic level and at the international level. And this referendum was really intended to be domestic. It wasn't intended to be, let's wreak havoc with the international markets. Of course, he should have known that this would have worked out this way, but I don't think he could have been thinking it through and realizing what the international community and the international markets would have done with his referendum. I think it's not as selfish as you make it out to be. The Greek Prime Minister was in a very, very difficult position. He has a very slim majority in his parliament, and he needs the support of the opposition in order to put through the reforms that will be needed in order to make that financial package that the people have made available to the Greeks to make that possible. And that will mean cutting a lot of public sector jobs. It will be cutting wages, cutting pensions, a lot of reforms that the Greeks haven't really got their heads around. A lot of simple day-to-day Greeks think that the crisis was caused by their elites, and they think that the elites should just solve it. In order to make this package a success, he needs a buy-in from basically everybody. He needs a buy-in from the opposition, and he needs a buy-in from the people. So in his view, by putting it to a referendum, he would be able to get the buy-in from the people. It was, however, very quickly clear that the referendum would end up being a referendum that officially says it's about this or that. You know, do you want the bailout package? Are you willing to prepare for this? I mean, the question had not really been determined. But it would very likely be a popularity contest on his leadership, which he would most likely lose. So without even knowing what the details was of the bailouts and how much it would cost everybody, the information within a day was this referendum is going to be negative. And of course that was going to be a real problem, because then there is more havoc in the markets for, you know, 4 weeks or however long it would be for them to organize the referendum. So the situation today that I thought was pretty exciting was not just the sort of the hour by hour unwinding of this whole story, but that eventually the conservative opposition realized that if this referendum were to go forward, the Greeks might have to leave the euro, and that the whole situation could be escalating out of control. So it was the opposition coming to the rescue of the prime minister by saying, okay, we will support this, that made the Greek prime minister decide that at this point he'll withdraw the referendum. Arguably, he got a lot of heat from the international partners in other places in Europe, so that he may have realized that this is just not the way to go.
Again, I'm speaking with Amy Van Dunn, who's a professor and chair of political science at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. She's in Europe at the moment. We're talking about the G20 conference going on in Cannes, and the less political and more theatrical aspects of it, Amy, are, of course, that the world's second richest person, Bill Gates, is there, along with a group of American nurses and the British actor Bill Nighy, who did a videotape where he played a selfish banker that went viral. He apparently appeared in a bed that the nurses put out to symbolize the global economy, but of course the nurses were saying that they don't leave any sick person behind, and we're appealing for the G20 leaders to show concern for the third world, if you will. Apparently that was Sarkozy's original idea in hosting this conference, that they'd actually be talking about how the richer nations can help the poorer nations, but clearly the crisis within the Eurozone precipitated by Greece has stolen taken the oxygen out of that, hasn't it?
Yes, I think this is a situation that looks a little bit more, if you like, a kamikaze compared to your day-to-day politics. This was a real crazy day with all of these activities going on.
And what explains, though, Amy Van Dunn, the fact that the politicians have, obviously the markets move a lot faster than the politicians do, and with the European Parliament having so many different voices that have to come to consensus, one understands why it is difficult, but still it's hard to understand how this crisis has gone on for so long, for years in fact, and as it is prolonged, the price of getting out of it goes up. They could have settled this surely a year or even two ago for pennies on the dollar.
Yeah. it's one of those things that keeps amazing observers on the whole European crisis. The background to why it wasn't solved earlier is found in Germany. The German leaders, when agreeing to monetary union with countries that were traditionally those who were easily choosing a devaluation route to remain competitive, felt that such a monetary union would require strict rules and no bailout of any countries. And that was written down in the treaty that everybody signed up on. So when this came by and it looked like the Greeks had cooked the books and their budgetary deficit was way higher than anybody had seen coming because of a statistical misrepresentation of the deficit, the Germans were just in no state of mind to say, oh yeah, that's no problem, let's bail you out, because that would have been completely contrary to the situation that they had signed up on. So it took them a good number of months, in fact you could argue years at this point, to realize that they're shooting themselves in the foot by not accepting that this is a political responsibility after having taken those economic steps to integrate Europe's single market with a single currency. And I think that's the lesson that comes out of all of this. If you were to ask those around the table, Sarkozy, Merkel, I mean, if you could settle this a year and a half ago for this price, they would have settled a long time ago, but they had no idea it was escalating out of control. Another element that comes out when you say, you know, how can they not settle this and why does it keep on spinning out of control, is that there are a lot of veto players. And the design of economic and monetary union at this time has only one element of the whole economic and monetary union at the supranational level, and that is the central bank. The European Central Bank is a supranational institution that could speak with one voice and is governed by one institution, and it's very clear who's in charge and what happens there. The other side of that, in most monetary unions, you have on the one hand this monetary authority, central bank, on the other hand this sort of fiscal authority, the sort of tax and spend authority. In the United States, it's a treasury, and you know, in federal jurisdictions, it's a government, a voted into power government that taxes and spends. And in the EU context, that authority is decentralized. So it is the national member states governments that tax and spend, and the system of coordination between this central bank on the one hand and these 27 fiscal authorities in the European Union and 17 in monetary union are decentralized. And the way to keep this coordinated is by a set of rules. Now, these rules have been undermined in various steps throughout the last couple of years. But the idea was that by agreeing to those rules, you would be able to coordinate without having to transfer sovereignty to a higher level. And this whole crisis shows that there's a flaw in the design, because as long as one of these countries can basically not stick to the rules, it could undermine the entire euro. And we saw that recently in one of the other Central and Eastern European countries, where the opposition just basically says, we don't support this. And so there seem to be a lot of veto players, a lot of national parliaments that can say, we don't like this, and now we're going to vote against. That makes people very worried.
And Amy Verdun, the proposals that were put forth apparently by Bill Gates, the world's second richest person, who was invited there by Sarkozy to talk about what was supposed to be the original agenda before the Greek grenade blew that up. He apparently, Gates's proposal, or at least a part of his proposal, is that, and this was designed for the rich countries to raise money to take care of the poor countries, he argues that a small tax on trades of stocks, derivatives, and other financial instruments, known as a financial transaction tax or a Wall Street speculation tax, or more commonly known as a Robin Hood tax. Apparently already 15 of the G20 countries have some form of securities transaction tax, but the United States certainly doesn't have it. And I can guarantee you that the banking lobby here in this country, the Wall Street lobby, will fight it tooth and nail. What's your sense of how that could get some traction?
Yeah, Yeah, Bill Gates' Robin Hood tax. I think it is a very interesting point of departure because it comes from a very wealthy American. We've had many calls for a Tobin tax, the same idea. It's an economist, Tobin, who said that you should just tax transactions. Typically, that will only work if you have some kind of world governance. If there is a market out there that does not do it, people say some of the transactions will simply go to that market. The European Union has been responding to the crisis in the early months by saying the European Union would regulate some kind of taxation on these kinds of transactions, only to discover that at least one country somewhere will say, well, then the market is going to move somewhere else. So these issues are very helpful as an idea of who you would tax in order to move some of the money from those who have a lot to those who don't have a lot. But it is a difficult thing to implement unless you get a lot of buy-in from many countries. So in a sense, by putting it at the G20 and by asking all the large leaders to participate, that would be the right place to do it. Because by just asking some of the individual countries to start doing this, it won't work in something so mobile as capital.
So just in closing, Amy Verdun, what this has clearly this crisis or these series of crises that have dragged on for so long that have made the European experiment look like it doesn't have its act together, to say the least. Obviously, it's at an important crossroads, particularly if Greece leaves and defaults. That could lead to others doing the same and to the end of the euro. The Sarkozy and Merkel have been adamant, saying they don't want that. But what can be done then to, one, fix this situation, and two, make sure it doesn't happen again, and in fact, make the European experiment more robust and more enduring?
It's one of those questions that has made this crisis very difficult. When we had economic and monetary union being designed, many observers said this will only work as long as the economic tide is positive. When there is a crisis, this will come to the fore, and the European Union will have to decide whether it will be further integrating in the areas of political and fiscal integration, or whether it wants to move back or deal with some of the problems of not having the full set of tools. And people didn't quite understand what that meant or what it would look like if it were not completely integrated, and I think that's now on the table. And any institutional change in Europe is typically slow, and one of the reasons why this has dragged on is it takes the Europeans some time to make decisions. Any such institutional change has to go through 27 member states, and they have to be ratified. In some cases, it requires a referendum. So they don't make major institutional changes to the structure of the European Union very easily or lightly. This will change. They will need to decide what kind of Europe do they want. They may need to make stricter rules, and they've got a number of proposals on the table, a so-called six-pack is on the table, to make sure that there's a bit more control over budgetary situation in member states. But it will take a little bit more time, and then they might have made those design changes so that they'll be a bit more able to deal with countries who are not complying with the rules originally set out to support the whole economic and monetary union.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Amy Verdun.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
And thank you for staying up so late. Again, I've been speaking with Amy Verdun, who's professor and chair of political science at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Her books include European Responses to Globalization and Financial Market Integration, Globalization, Development and Integration, and her latest, Ruling Europe, The Politics of the Stability and Growth Pact. She's also co-editor of the Journal of Common Market Studies. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about whether or not Israel will attack Iran or the United States will attack Iran.
Banks fold, presidents scratching his head, the economy is down, Wall Street about to move him, I'm up and down, gas prices up and down, nobody knows what to do. You know what we need, though?
Sister, 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 sister
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Dreyfus, an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism, and national security for the nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, and he was profiled as a leading investigative journalist by the Columbia Journalism Review, won two awards from the Washington Monthly, and was presented Project Censored's first prize for a story on the role of oil in the U.S. policy towards Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Dreyfus.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
And we've, for some time, there have been rumors of war vis-a-vis Israel and Iran and or a combination of the U.S. and Israel striking Iran. These seem to be heating up again. There's also, I believe, a report coming out next week by the IAEA that's expected to be fairly damning about Iran's secret nuclear program that may be fodder for hawks on this side, not to mention the hawks on the Israeli side. Where do you, how do you assess this uptick in rumors of war?
Well, the first thing I would say is that for almost a decade now, since we heard about Iran's nuclear program, there have been predictions, you know, consistently that Iran was a year or two away from having a bomb, and now it's 10 years later, and they don't have a bomb. We've also heard a lot of predictions in the media and elsewhere that Israel or the United States or both are about 6 months away or a year away from striking Iran to destroy its nuclear program. And, of course, that's never happened either. And I think there's a lot of propaganda in all of these reports because, at bottom, I think the main function of these reports, at least in the media, is to try to increase the pressure on Iran in terms of sanctions and isolation, both politically and economically, and other types of pressure to, you know, contain Iran and restrain its influence in the region. On the other hand, we can't completely dismiss these reports. I mean, they're certainly a remote possibility, and I say remote because the consequences would be so devastating, a remote possibility that Israel might take on its own the opportunity to strike Iran. That's an exceedingly difficult undertaking for Israel, which is, after all, a small country. The United States could do it more easily, but when I say easily, it's still an extraordinarily difficult and ugly idea, the idea of the United States attacking Iran. And I don't think either the Bush administration or especially the Obama administration has any intent, plans, whatever, about attacking Iran. I think they've not only decided that it would be a bad idea and stupid, but I think they've communicated in the strongest terms to Israel that Israel, too, should you know, put this idea on the shelf.
Well, Bob Dreyfus, just last week at a congressional hearing on Iran, the Congress was told that the Pentagon has a series of contingency plans that range from covert action, more cyber warfare, sanctions, and sanctions that could target Iran's central bank, which would be a serious move tantamount to a declaration of war. Apparently, the president's...
The Pentagon doesn't have contingency plans in regard to Iran's central bank, so I don't know whose report that is.
Right.
The Pentagon has contingency plans to invade Canada and Mexico, and no doubt to send troops to New Zealand, too. But that doesn't mean a damn thing. That's their job, is to draw up, you know, plans on what it would take to move such and much troops over to such and much place and so forth. But the military leadership in the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense, and the White House have no intention of attacking Iran. It would make no sense. It would be devastating to the world economy. It would completely throw the world oil market into turmoil. It would probably lead to Iran counterattacking, first of all, in Iraq and Afghanistan, where they have a lot of influence, maybe across the Gulf into the oil countries on the other side of the Persian Gulf, and using their proxy forces like Hezbollah and others against Israel, along with other possibilities, including terrorism in the United States. So the consequences would be horrible, and the accomplishment of such an attack would be very questionable. So on both of these grounds, I think the United States has, you know, pretty much ruled this out. That's not to say that you can't find a bunch of hawks and neoconservatives and others who are beating the war drums as they've done for the past 10 years, perhaps even 20 years. You know, we can go back to the 1990s easily when Newt Gingrich was pushing for, you know, covert action to overthrow the Iranian government. This has been a long-standing idea in Washington, but that doesn't mean that it's going to happen. I think we need to be cautiously optimistic that the current stalemate between Iran and the United States will persist, and not that either side is going to suddenly gain some huge advantage or, you know, to go to war.
Well, at this same congressional hearing on Iran last week, retired General Jack Keane said we've got to put our hands around their throat now. So there's an example of what you just were describing. But also recently, the Iranian news agency quoted Iran's military chief saying, "The Zionist regime's military attack against Iran will inflict heavy damages to the U.S. as well as the Zionist regime." So,
Yeah. Well, you know, these Iranian leaders, by the way, there's a flip side to that. They're hawks in their own way, and they get a lot of mileage out of being able to tell their population that we're being threatened. Look what this general told Congress. Look what some Israeli general said. And so they can whip up, you know, a kind of a nationalist defensive reaction when they hear this kind of talk, too. So this works on both sides of the equation. The Iranians have a very delicate political situation inside their country, as you know, ever since 2009, when there was the controversial re-election episode by President Ahmadinejad, and the so-called Green Movement and others started massively turning out to protest the election results.
Well, you were there, weren't you, Bob?
I was there in Iran. I saw it for myself. I know that the Iranian leaders are worried and concerned about the Arab Spring kind of, you know, breath of fresh air wafting eastward toward Iran again. And so, you know, it's certainly, ironically, when the hawks talk like this, it helps maintain the regime in power and not undermine them.
So you have an article out now. Actually, let me find out where. Well, I read it on, I think, Asia Global. What was it written?
I wrote for the Nation.
Oh, for the Nation. Okay, yeah. Let me repeat that then. You have an article out now, Robert Dreyfus, again, investigative journalist, written extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism, and national security, the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. You have an article out now at The Nation that kind of refutes these rumors of war. For example, the Guardian out of the United Kingdom is quoting the UK Armed Forces chiefs and at the Ministry of Defense, saying that they're stepping up contingency plans along with the United States. I've talked to people in JSOC who said that, that one of the reasons why Obama agreed to this quick pull out of Iraq was that they wanted to get American troops out of there so there'd be no hostages if there were to be an attack on Iran. So it's hard to keep pace with these things.
Well, you know, by the way, I mean, Obama didn't suddenly decide to pull troops out of Iraq. The Iraqis told us to get lost.
Right, and that was an agreement that Bush had made. In any case, it was his exit date. They wouldn't change, right?
Well, but Obama had no choice about to take the troops out or not. So the idea that they're hurrying the troops out of Iraq in order to clear the decks for an attack on Iran is just silliness, because the United States has been drawing down its forces in Iraq now for 3 years, and the Iranians are more than happy to see us go. They don't want our forces on their border. On the other hand, this is not, and they certainly used their influence with the Iraqi government to help show us the door so that the Iraqis would not ask us, in fact, to stick around a little longer.
Well, at the risk of beating a dead horse, my understanding is from a mutual friend of ours, a former intelligence officer, who's in touch with the State Department daily. He just told me that the State Department is absolutely adamant that this Iranian plot is for real, and that Jaber, of course, he was featured in the WikiLeaks documents as the Saudi Arabian who called to chop off what he called the head of the snake, meaning Iran. There was an assassination of a Saudi diplomat recently in Karachi that's been linked to the Iranians. So if this bizarre attack, and admittedly the idea of using a used car salesman from Texas, an Iranian-American, a Mexican drug cartel hitman to kill the Saudi ambassador at his favorite restaurant in Washington, in Georgetown, does seem a little bizarre, but they're sticking by their story. So does that mean, if this is true, that this regime is becoming unhinged?
Well, I think you can argue, on one level, this is a regime that's been unhinged for 30 years. It's run by a bunch of medieval-minded mullahs. Many of them have never even been outside the country. They're religious reactionaries. Their conception of the West and the United States is, less than perfect. I don't necessarily doubt that they were planning something in terms of an assassination against the Saudi ambassador, although it seems like it was not the most smoothly planned and impressive operation, if that's indeed what it was. The Iranians, are not a very smoothly functioning country. Their intelligence services is not some vast, well-oiled machine. It's a chaotic mess. And so is their regime. And so it's not impossible that they could have used a used car salesman and, his supposed ties to Mexican mafias and everything else to plan an attack. On the other hand, it doesn't also necessarily follow that this was some grand scheme cooked up at the very top of the Iranian regime. It might have been something that kind of just bubbled up through the mid-level ranks of their Quds force, and they got caught. I think Obama has responded fairly well to this thing. He hasn't been bombastic. He hasn't called for war. He's said we take this seriously, and I guess had the previous president been in office, there might be warships sailing into the Persian Gulf now with lots of threatening noises coming out of the vice president, and that would only serve to raise tensions and lead to possible confrontation.
Well, Bob Dreyfus, I'm sure you're aware of Condoleezza Rice's new book in which apparently Dick Cheney warned them all that they're about to die from a botulism attack. And it really makes you realize how lucky we are not to have this guy in the White House as the de facto president. I mean, he obviously did not make a distinction between his own fear of mortality and the rest of our jeopardy.
Yes, well, as we know, throughout the 8 years of the Bush presidency, George Bush was only a heartbeat away from the presidency because Dick Cheney's ill-ticking heart was always a question.
And he corralled all the information and the flow. And he was the guy, by the way, that went after the great shock and awe invasion of Iraq.
To Bush's credit, by the way, it's important to point out that when Cheney did go to Bush at the end of his term, I think in 2007, and said we need to plan an attack on Iran, Bush turned him down. And so I think, you know, it isn't fair to say that Cheney was controlling everything. Bush was at least prudent enough, as his father might have said, to reject Cheney's suggestion that we go to war against Iran 5 years ago. And so
I think Rice's book almost implies that in his second term he kind of woke up and realized that how much Cheney had usurped his own presidency.
Yeah, and I think that Bush was upset that the Iraq war turned out to be such a fiasco. And, of course, Bush himself probably didn't have a clue about what it was going to look like. And you know, when he when it looked like his presidency was going to be destroyed over the war in Iraq, I think he might have had to start to have second thoughts about both Cheney and Rumsfeld. And, of course, he fired Rumsfeld in 2006, and Cheney objected to that. So there was a kind of dim awareness that was beginning to dawn on George W. Bush that maybe some of his colleagues weren't necessarily the best choices in the first term.
Well, Robert Dreyfus, again, investigative journalist, has written extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism, and national security, and he's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Just to wrap up these rumors of war between Israel and Iran and now between the United States and Iran, whether or not the Israelis, the only way that we could talk the Israelis out of it was saying, wait a minute, we'll do it for you. I mean, I'm sort of joking. I know it is a serious matter. But what do you understand when they're talking about contingency plans involving cyber warfare? Of course, we're always told that Russia and China are doing terrible things vis-a-vis cyber warfare and penetrating our mainframes and all this kind of stuff. Nothing is ever said about what we do. But clearly this Stuxnet virus that infected the Iranian nuclear program, there's beginning some evidence now mounting that this was in fact developed here in the United States and either given to Israel or stolen by Israel. What do you know about them?
Well, I think that's probably right, and if so, it was an act of war, because you can't send viruses into the national security apparatus of another country without it be considering it being an act of war. And it's very possible that it started as long ago as the Bush administration era too. So it isn't necessarily an Obama administration project. In any case, I think maybe too much was made of that virus, because or worm, whatever it was, because the Iranian nuclear program seems to have stumbled but recovered in the wake of that event. But yes, you're right. We do in the United States have a very robust capability of using electronic and computer attacks against another nation. In fact, it was considered very seriously in the Libya case, where the United States got involved in air support to the rebels there, but considered as well unleashing a cyber war campaign against Libya. And I'm sure there are hundreds and hundreds of people in the military here who've specialized in nothing but how to shut down another country's communication systems and transport systems and financial systems and other things in the case of conflict.
Well, just in closing then, Robert Dreyfus, what do you think this report that's expected next week from the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is expected to provide further evidence of a possible nuclear weapons program in Iran, surely the hawks will seize on that?
Well, I don't know if it's going to provide real hard evidence of a nuclear weapons program. There's been very, very little, almost nothing in that regard. You judge Iran on its intentions. You know, why are they so intent on refining that much uranium, and why are they doing it in the face of the cost to their economy through sanctions and other problems if it's not to build a nuclear bomb? But no one has found evidence, at least that I'm aware of, other than very, very thin slivers of, you know, pieces of sort of hints, wisps of information that they actually have a bomb program. And maybe that's because they don't have a bomb program yet, although it's not a bad idea if you're going to develop one to start with a bunch of refined uranium. So maybe they're kind of at the early stages of this, and since we can't predict what they're going to do in the future and, you know, read their minds, we don't know what direction this is going to go in a few years.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Robert Dreyfus.
Yeah, thank you. Pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Dreyfus, an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism, and national security. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, and he has an article out now at The Nation refuting much of the these rumors of war persisting between the Israel, the notions being that Israel is planning an attack on Iran, and perhaps now the United States is. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with a different opinion of whether the United States is about to go to war with Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Sale, who has been reporting on intelligence since the late 1970s. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and is the author of Clinton's Secret Wars. He has an article at Truth Out, U.S. and Israel Tech Teams Develop Malworm to Take Down Iran's Computer Software. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Sale.
Thank you very much.
And your article follows on from the Stuxnet story that the U.S. and Israelis have developed an improved version called Malworm. And it's extraordinary to learn from your article, Richard, that Sergey Brin at Google, Steve Ballmer at Microsoft, and Larry Ellison at Oracle have been working with Israel's top cyber warriors.
Yes.
What's your sense of because I understand the Stuxnet was very effective, and next week the International Atomic Energy Agency is expected to issue a report saying that the Iranian program is going ahead, and that is likely to give fodder to hawks on both in Israel and the United States. So if the Stuxnet was so effective, how come the Iranians are up and running again?
Well, they're not up and running. I mean, I think that, frankly, it's a ludicrous opinion. There's no doubt the Israeli hawks are clamoring for war, but they're not doing a very good job of it. Their country's enormously divided. But in any case, Stuxnet was extremely effective, and the new versions will even be more so. The Iranians are trying very hard to develop a counter, but they're not having much success in doing that.
Well, our previous guest, Robert Dreyfus, I mentioned the Stuxnet virus, and he said, you know, that is, in fact, an act of war to insert a virus into another country's mainframe.
Well, I don't know about that. I'm not a legal expert, so I couldn't tell you.
Right.
I just know that it took enormous amounts of money. It was done over a period of years. Whoever inserted it in Iran, and I'm absolutely positive the Israelis and the Americans did it. They developed a model of the Iranian machinery, and were able then to insert the virus. It works in this way. Part of the virus, it works as reconnaissance. It covers weaknesses in the Iranian computer system, and the Israeli segment of it inserts those into the machines.
And this caused these cascades of centrifuges spin at 86,000 RPM. So
that's right. Not only that, you know, they're set in a way that the damage is not being recorded, right. So the machines appear to be functioning normally.
So this IAE report that's coming out next week, that's supposed to be alarming and give grist to the mill.
Because I've been talking to very former senior U.S. intelligence officials, and their stance is if this new report be very good, because they don't expect it to produce anything new.
So what about then other reports that one hears that when this plot was uncovered and announced by Eric Holder, that an Iranian-American used car salesman down in Texas had somehow got together with the Mexican drug cartel hitman to kill Saudi ambassador at his favorite Georgetown restaurant. A lot of people thought that was pretty off the wall, but I keep hearing from people in the State Department, they're absolutely convinced this is for real. So
I would disagree. I mean, they may say that. It's part of their job, but it's not real at all. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence saying that the Iranian government at any level was involved in this. It strikes me as nonsense, frankly. That's not the way the Iranians pay for their operations anyway. They don't use drug cartel money.
So the theory is that the Saudis are pushing, as we know that Jabai, in the WikiLeaks document, the same ambassador that was allegedly a target of the Iranian and the Mexican hitman, he is the one that talked about cutting off the head of the snake vis-a-vis Iran. We know that there's a lot of tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia. A Saudi ambassador was murdered recently in Karachi, supposedly by the Iranians. The Iranians replaced Iran's second biggest customer for oil, India, because of banking sanctions. And in this recent hearing last week in the Congress, where U.S. Congressmen were told that the Pentagon has contingency plans, and there are even contingency plans to shut down Iran's central bank, which sounds like a kind of casus belli. Retired General Jack Keane said, "We've got to put our hands around their throat now." So, where do you think is this just rhetoric on our hawks?
The Israelis have been hungering for this strike as early as May. Officials in DOD have been doing one classified study war game after the next, you know, dealing with all the alternatives and scenarios. This has been very serious. But it's interesting that the people who are in DOD or who are performing these contingency drills and whatever, they're against the intelligence. They can practice this stuff, but they do not believe it will happen. And they, again, their stance is, again, that the Iranian program came to an end in 2003. So the Israelis can say what they want, but they would have to drag the United States into it. And, of course, Britain is now talking about, well, if the U.S. is dragged into it, then they'll come in as well. But it just doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, I'm a big student of history. So if I look at 1914 and you look at all the incredibly illogical and highly emotional errors that were committed at that time, I'm not saying that something like that could occur in this instance, but I don't think it will happen.
Well, aren't there very compelling reasons why it's reckless beyond belief? Because of the price of oil.
Nobody could buy the kind of weaponry that would hit Israel and the retaliation would just be unbelievable. In addition, Iran would activate all of its sleeper networks in the United States and in Latin America. You would have incredible strikes on the mass transit systems and everything. It would just be horrible beyond belief.
And you're talking about the Hezbollah being Iran's surrogate. They've got extended missiles, right?
And
rockets to rain down on Israel.
Now the Russians are getting into the act. They just sold a whole bunch of jammers, you know, to protect Iran's air defense systems, things like that. I mean, everybody's flexing their muscles, but again, who really wants to risk this?
Well, the president in an election year would, of course, get the same treatment that Bill Clinton did over Monica Lewinsky, you know, that he's trying to distract the American people from domestic failures. The oil prices would go through the ceiling. The recession would deepen. There'd have to be an awfully good reason to do this.
As I say, I don't think it exists. If you go through all the different factors, I think you have to place great weight on the U.S. intelligence assessments on this. And they're always being interpreted by everybody. It's almost like the ridiculous language of the FBI describing the Iranian plot. I love it when a CIA informant suddenly says, I take this to mean in terms of my experience, it's such and such. It's just nonsense. You know, there's so much room for loose wording and laxness of thought. You run into real disasters.
Well, my understanding that the plot was designed to be exercised at the time of the Hajj, when there's a lot of Iranian pilgrims, in the hope that they would provoke the Saudis into an angry overreaction against this Iranian pilgrims.
The Saudis can be very hot-tempered. I remember back in 1988, I guess, the Saudis killed over 400 people that began to riot during the Hajj. So, I mean, the Saudis are certainly not above slaughter in this matter, but I don't think they're beating the drum on this. It strikes me as a bit hollow.
So then is this some kind of psyop that we're all being suckered into talking about? Is just to make the mullahs nervous? Is that what's going on?
I think so. Absolutely. I think the actual goal of all this is to, what will emerge from there are really very drastic sanctions against Iran. You're not going to have a regional war. I mean, I'd stick my reputation on it. Again, barring any act by some lunatic, but the Israeli military staff is very, very intelligent, very, very skilled, very well trained, and they're not stupid. And they're not going to do something that's disastrous to their own interests.
And then what is the likelihood of, I mean, one of the other theories out there, and I don't want to beat a dead horse here, is that you know, Petraeus was sent to the CIA for a good reason, that they've developed a good kind of working MO, that Obama is actually quite aggressive in terms of foreign policy, but not in the clumsy Bush boots on the ground way, but in a more subtle way, and that they're
much more subtle.
That they feel that the Libyan experiment worked out really well, and they're replicating that now in Somalia with using other boots on the ground and their own air assets.
Well, the Saudis played a major role in giving us intelligence that have caused us to be effective on the ground in Yemen and hitting targets in Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the Saudis are all over a lot on this, but they're very reliable intelligence sources when it comes to Yemen. And extracting al-Qaeda. But the main thing is to remember that when Panetta went to Israel, his message was to say we could not be dragged into a war. And that's one of the reasons they were talking about the new virus. And the new virus is very, very interesting, by the way. It's sort of a two-tier job. It's the intelligence phase. It's an intelligence gathering instrument at the moment. And it can then later on deliver virus attacks on facilities. The new virus called Dooku, I don't know how you pronounce it. But anyway, it's already been, certain European firms have already been targeted by it.
So just to follow up on the idea of the Obama foreign policy, defense intelligence policy being more subtle, less heavy-handed, they're sort of on a roll from their, in quotes, success in Libya. Is there any possibility of the Green Revolution reigniting and having the same situation that NATO had in Libya, in as much as you're not sending in your forces, you're helping the Libyan people overthrow a dictator, or in this case, the Iranian people overthrow a dictatorship?
Well, I don't think the freedom agenda is working for Obama. I just don't. I mean, his foreign policy is indirect. I mean, they were going to use, at one point they were considering using the new virus on installations in Libya. and they, at the last minute, they retreated from that. But they have a lot of weapons in their, a lot of arrows in their quiver, and they're very clever about using them.
So, but just in terms of what's happening in terms of, the Iranian Nobel laureate Shirin Ebadi says that that the Green Movement is still alive. It is the embers burning under the ashes.
I would think that's accurate. Now, what can they do?
They can't do much. They can't, because they've already had their heads cracked by the IRGC.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it is a very rigid, very, very ideological and very ruthless dictatorship. It's very hard to move around or have any latitude for operation.
So there is no way then to do anything about this regime, militarily or through other measures? Is that your conclusion?
Well, Khamenei now is driving all this in Iran. And
his son, right? His son is supposed to be the real operative, right?
And he's got former Quds operators of long standing with him and that sort of thing. But, what is their effectiveness going to be? I mean, if they haven't even developed their own counter to the malware, what are they going to do? I mean, they're trying, but they don't have it.
Right.
So I don't think the idea that, suddenly we're going to be confronted with an Iranian bomb is, I think, it's just nonsense.
Right. Well, but the leadership itself, in your opinion, Richard Sale, even though they're incredibly paranoid about their own people, you don't think that they're going to be unseated anytime soon?
I wish they would, but I just don't see it happening.
I see.
I really don't. That was Khomeini erected this particular form of government, and it really is a very, very oppressive theocracy. So, I don't see anybody getting much relief from it.
No. Well, it would be the ultimate nightmare here in the United States to be ruled by Pat Robinson.
it would be, you can imagine, Pat Robinson and Michelle Bachmann, that'd be wonderful, wouldn't it?
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us, Richard Sale.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Sale, who's been reporting on intelligence since the 1970s. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and is the author of Clinton's Secret Wars. He has an article at Truth Out, U.S. and Israeli Tech Teams Develop Malware to Take Down Iran's Computer Software. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and Natalie Movsisian. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.